The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. I must tell you, 7 years is all it took for us to get John Durham's report and to tie a bow on FBI misconduct during the investigation into Russia, Russia, Russia. That's the headline today. Durham report sharply criticizes FBI's 2016 Trump campaign probe. Wall Street Journal, FBI faulted for its probe of Russian meddling in 2016 campaign. New York Times, in final report, Trump-era special counsel denounces Russia investigation over across the pond in Great Britain. FBI, quote, should never have investigated Trump's links to 2016 election report finds. This comes along at the same time that New York Post reports that the IRS has removed the investigative team in diving into the Hunter Biden tax fraud. The whistleblower is saying it's clearly retaliatory. So what do we know? We know that the permanent government is very anti-Republican, very anti-Trump, and they crippled the Trump presidency from the beginning. We have here Devin Nunes, who was head of the Intel Committee for time under President Trump before Adam, the lying guy, Schiff, took over. Cut number 11, Devin Nunes yesterday talking on Newsmax with Chris Salcedo.
No, and look, Chris, this is just breaking now. And, you know, it's a over 300-page report. And, you know, one of the things that we need to do is, and I need to do as somebody who worked on this for many years, is I need to go and read that report. And, you know, so far it looks like there is a lot of, it's brought a lot of clarity to some issues just in my first read of it. But you've asked this, you've focused in on the right thing, and that is, who's going to pay a price? And the answer is, no one's going to pay a price. But that was always the case. I think I had said this earlier this year, that the longer Durham was there, the better it was. Hopefully Durham could get as much as he could in this report. But here's the thing. At the end of the day, the Biden administration controls what Durham does. And, you know, until Durham speaks, we're not going to know, you know, did he make these decisions or did someone pressure him? But it was always kind of a head scratcher when they brought these indictments that were they into Washington, D.C., and really Durham put the FBI on and the DOJ on trial there. So I take this from my early just perusing of the report, and that is that the Department of Justice and the FBI are solely owned by the Democratic Party and their propaganda machine. And this Durham report ought to scare the living hell out of everyone, because think about this. It's only gotten worse since this time period. We're talking
about it's not going to scare anyone, because it's 7 years ago and people aren't even going to pay attention. John Yoo was on Fox with Neil Cavuto yesterday summarizing the Durham report. Cut number two.
It's really interesting. And you have to have a lot of sympathy for Durham, because there's a lot of things you could do here. But he's only really narrowly focused on charging people with federal crimes with proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a tiny amount of the whole universe of things that could happen to reform this situation. The other thing I think he brings to light, which really is also outside his purview, is how intertwined the Hillary Clinton campaign was with the Obama administration and the intelligence and law enforcement agencies.
And stop right there. Of course it was. And we all knew that. And 7 years for Durham to put a bow on it. So I'm pretty confident that by 2031, we'll know all about Hunter Biden and the false corporations and the LLCs and the 20 bank accounts. And I'm sure we'll know, get to the bottom of it. Meanwhile, the debt ceiling negotiations are underway. From the Financial Times, White House and Republicans start to shape debt ceiling. And then the Wall Street Journal, debt ceiling talks, a late start, amps up pressure on Congress. No, it doesn't. The pressure's on Joe Biden. He waited 100 days to do anything about it. And from Politico comes word that the left is worried about what Joe Biden is giving away. Elizabeth Warren, I'm very concerned about any efforts to just tangle aid recipients in red tape. They don't want any work requirements. This is Kevin McCarthy in the House hallway yesterday. Cut number three.
It just seems that they want to look like they're in a meeting, but they're not. They're not talking anything serious. And in the meantime, we just watched the CBO come out and say we're $100 billion further in debt. And so seems more like they want to default than a deal to me.
And then more Kevin McCarthy at a press conference, cut number four.
And the only body in all of Congress are the Republicans who raised the debt ceiling. And we did it way in advance before Janet Yellen told us when the deadline was, because we didn't want to be here. So, no, I don't think we're in a good place. I know we're not. This ignoring the problem, thinking it's going to go away, he could bumble his way just into a default like he did on the border. That's what we didn't want to have happen. So we raised the debt limit. We're protecting. I don't know. Maybe his secret plan is to wait till the last minute and pass our bill. I'm okay with that.
Bumbling Joe Biden. And that is about right. Couple of political notes. Former Vice President Mike Pence is leaning towards running in 2024. New York Times says he's using Reagan's playbook, not Trump's. And Politico reports that Scott Reed is very, very smart. And Jeb Hensarling, who used to run the Financial Services Committee and is very, very smart, are going to lead the pro-Pence super PAC. More on that as it develops. I've invited the vice president back onto the show. Governor DeSantis yesterday banned universities in Florida from spending money on DEI. This is a very good development. New York Times, DeSantis signs bill defunding diversity spending in state schools. And the law has outraged faculty, which means it must be a pretty good thing. The legislation he signed banned Florida's public universities and colleges from spending money on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives and imposed other measures that could reshape higher education at state schools. Basically means they're going to put hundreds of DEI bureaucrats out of business. Meanwhile, the Washington Post puffs up Bob Iger, the head of Disney, whose company is just completely failing to impress markets, as the match for DeSantis in Florida. I'm telling you, there is no corporate executive in America who can beat a popularly elected governor. That's the end of that. If he wants to drive down his shareholder value, that's fine. Donald Trump attacked Ron DeSantis yesterday on abortion, suggesting the six-week abortion limit is too harsh. I think this is misguided by the former president. Karl Rove does as well on Fox with Martha McCollum saying this, cut number one.
Petty, small, and unimportant. I mean, look, he better spend his time. The former president is better spending his time talking about what it is that he wants to do rather than trying to run down his opponents. Right now, Ron DeSanctimonious. I mean, first of all, what does that mean? I mean, Ron DeSantis has higher favorables than the former president. So he's sort of punching down in one way, somebody that not everybody knows, but also punching up because a guy is more popular than he is. So we'll see how this all plays out. But I think the former president's making a mistake. Think about this. Over the last couple of months, he's been doing everything he can to diminish the expectations for the entry of Governor DeSantis into the race. So Governor DeSantis goes to Iowa and has a good visit in Sioux Center, has a great fundraiser in the eastern part of the state, has a surprise event where he stops in Des Moines where Donald Trump was supposed to have a rally. Before he comes into the state, the Republican Senate leader and the House Republican majority leader both endorse him along with 30 of their colleagues. That's a pretty good start. But the expectations were so low that everybody's now saying, look at DeSantis. He's having a fantastic visit to Iowa. Mm. Now, he's having a pretty good visit to Iowa, but it looks even better because Donald Trump has lowered expectations for him, and he's beating those expectations.
I got to say, the campaign's so far away from even the first debate in August that all of this is so much maneuvering. I just want to get the field set. Ukraine shot down six hypersonic missiles fired by Russia. I'm sure the CIA is on the ground recovering them. Erdogan has got a big lead in Turkey over his opponent, and the opponent was supposed to do well, and therefore NATO is still alarmed. One of the leading Likud the architect of the judicial overhaul, Mr. Rothman, says some overhaul bills will be passed soon if the opposition doesn't come to the table and talk seriously about what is going on. And then a story I missed yesterday, which must not stand. Chocolate milk faces potential ban in school cafeterias. Seriously, complete collapse in American schools over the last year, and they're worried about chocolate milk. That's because bureaucrats got a bureaucrat. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether or not you believe anyone. Let me do the market update brought to you by Birch Gold. Go to HughGold.com, HughGold.com. Gold this morning is at $2,013 an ounce, down a little bit. The Dow was up 47 points yesterday. The S&P up 12. The NASDAQ up 80. Amazon went up 0.85%, while everything else, like the Dow, went up 0.14%. Again, I think money is fleeing back into Big Tech as a high wall, big moat set of stocks continue to grow and the rest of the market just sorts of churns. But gold at $2,013 an ounce is better than it was when it was at $2,050, but it's going to stay above $2,000. If you want to start an IRA or a 401k or a SEP IRA or roll over one of your old IRAs into a physical precious metals IRA at a depository administered by a independent third party as required by the IRS, go to HughGold.com, request the free information kit, or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 989898, and they'll be right back at you. Stay tuned, America. I'll be right back on the Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. David Drucker is the lead political correspondent for The Dispatch. You see him on all of the networks. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. How's it going?
Good. I am struck, David, by it's been a week since the town hall that Donald Trump did in New Hampshire. And I'm struck by one thing in particular, which is that the audience has come in for a lot of criticism for clapping at various points along the way. Now, the Republican Party is 49% for Trump, 25% for DeSantis, and the rest is split among Mike Pence and some other folks. So the audience didn't always clap, and not all of the audience clapped at certain parts. But when have you ever seen a partisan audience criticized for being partisan before?
Well, I don't know if we've seen it before, Hugh. But I think that one of the reasons some people may be criticizing the audience is, one, it was impossible to tell from watching on television whether it was a partial audience applause or a full audience applause. So you just hear the laugh. You know, it's like watching a sitcom, right, where you hear the laugh track. And you don't actually know if everybody in the audience, when they hold up that sign, is laughing. But that's what it sounds like. I'd say the other thing, and look, this is open for debate here, but Trump was asked about the verdict in E. Jean Carroll case and a number of things relating to January 6th and things like that. And Trump was his usual self, which is kind of half charming, half funny, half charismatic, you know, a smattering of this or that. But some of the things that the audience was applauding and laughing at, or so it appeared on television, were when he was commenting on those things. So it's not like he said, hey, I'm going to cut your taxes, or, hey, you know, the border's a mess. And then they clapped or laughed because he, you know, said it in a particular way. It's because he was talking about E. Jean Carroll in a particular way. It's because he was talking about what happened on January 6th in a particular way. And so I think for a lot of Republicans that do not like Trump, for all the reasons that we don't need to repeat here because we already know the answers, they found the audience particularly disheartening because it tells them in their minds that we're still a minority in a party that Trump still leads.
Yeah, but I'm thinking more of mainstream media, legacy media, which won't cover Durham very closely because it's an old story and there's nothing new there. So I don't blame them for that. It's not much of a story. But I am struck by the contempt for which the contempt in which mainstream media holds a Trump voter. I don't think anyone can debate the statement that the mainstream legacy media holds Trump voters in contempt. I mean, real dripping contempt. Do you agree with me, David, or disagree?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily disagree. It may or may not be true. And look, I've run into reporters because I'm a reporter, so I hang out with other reporters, especially on the road. I know some of them feel that way. I know a lot of them don't, or some do and some don't, or a lot do and a lot don't. I'm not trying to cast a judgment here on based on facts I don't have in hand. So I'm not saying you're necessarily wrong, but I would point to the audience laughing at particular parts of Trump's response to questions from Caitlin Collins and say that I think, you know, a lot of people might have found that a little bit uncomfortable. So
I'm sure
they did.
You're not
necessarily off base at times.
I'm sure they did.
This is a way to judge that.
I'm sure they did react to that particular thing. But as I've explained on this show at length, the verdict in Carroll v. Trump is a right strawy verdict, to quote Luther on the Epistle of James. It doesn't add up to a lawyer. 27 years later, when she can't name the year, I just paid no attention to it because it's just so profoundly not corroborated. And they rejected the rape charge, but they accepted the assault charge, but they accepted the defamation charge. They rejected the rape charge, and they did it in 3 hours. I just shook my head. So a lot of people think it's just a bogus Manhattan jury. They just think it's a get Trump moment. Whether or not they like Trump, a lot of people think it's a bogus lawsuit. So, David, why doesn't the media just report that half the country likes Trump and half hates him, or 40% of the country likes Trump and they don't care about Jean Carroll, and they put January 6th aside and they don't blame him for that? Because that's basically the fact pattern. I mean, that's just 40% of America. That's 120 million Americans.
Yeah, look, I don't have an answer for you, in part because I'm not a media reporter, meaning I don't ask these questions of them. I don't really look deep into it. What I try to do is what I did in Iowa this past weekend. It's just ask questions and report the answers to those questions as fairly and accurately and within context as I can. Trump is this unique figure. I will say, as a reporter, I sometimes feel challenged in covering Trump because he will say things. You know, I've covered politicians now for 20 years, and they all spin and they all try and make things look a particular way when they don't, when they're not a particular way. Trump, it just happens to be the most brazen among them, and that he'll say something is blue when it's white, and he just does that. And
you have to build up your Trump immunity. You really do have to build up your Trump immunity.
Right, but I'm caught in this vortex of, well, when I'm writing the story, do I just let him say it? Do I not let him say it? Do I let him say it and correct him? And I don't want to be in the story, and I don't want to be the story, so I don't want to actually interject myself. I just want to present people with accurate and fair information that tells them what they need to know to use information or not use it. That's their choice. So I don't actually have a good answer for you, but I'm trying.
I don't actually think it's conscious, David, on the part of legacy media. It's just in the water now, like chlorinated water or fluoride infused water. You don't taste it. It's just there, and it doesn't hurt you in most cases. David Drucker, good to talk to you as always. Follow him at David M. Drucker, lead correspondent for The Dispatch. Follow me in the next hour, America, on YouTube. Opening off the hour with Wisconsin representative and chairman of the Select Committee on China, Chinese Communist Party, Congressman Mike.
There's no failure in sports.
Gallagher. So good morning, Chairman Mike. How are you?
It's always great to be with you, Hugh. You're so gracious with these intros.
Look, I just want people to know Wisconsin is different. You're very forgiving. And now we're going to turn to the Chinese Communist Party, and I hope you're as forgiving towards them. I had a dinner. I'm going to see you later today. I had a dinner, a lunch last week with three smart people, one of whom is a foreign national, two of whom are Democrats. All three of whom agreed that China wasn't going to attack Taiwan. They would prefer to absorb it by osmosis and take many years, and they'll just buy the island like they did Hong Kong. And I thought to myself, boy, oh boy, the left doesn't want to deal with the reality of the Chi-Coms. How do you get through to people like this that we could wake up any morning and see an invasion?
Well, let me start by paraphrasing what Churchill said at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, which is to say there's no doubt that the Soviet Union does not want war. They want the fruits of war and an unimpeded expansion of their power and ideological objectives. The same is true of Xi Jinping. No doubt he would prefer to absorb Taiwan via political warfare rather than actual warfare. Yet he repeatedly is telling us that he is prepared to use force if necessary to achieve his life's ambition. And what these people need to do is pay attention to what Xi Jinping says when he talks not to the Davos crowd, but when he talks to his own party membership. And on that point, he has been crystal clear that he is prepared to use force if necessary, particularly when, as I believe will happen, he realizes that achieving that objective of reunification of Taiwan with the mainland, cannot be achieved via political warfare because the DPP is going to win the election in Taiwan in January of 2024. So if Ukraine has taught us anything, it is that we should listen to dictators when they tell us in plain language what they intend to do. And if we ignore that because we graft our own Western sensibilities onto Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping and we do mirror imaging, we do so at our own peril. The risks of an invasion are increasing. The fact that the administration is now doubling down on an economic engagement strategy with China represents the triumph of delusion over bitter experience.
You're referring to Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, going to Vienna for 2 days of talks with Chinese counterparts, which was wildly celebrated, congratulatory. It's a little bit of Munich appeasement. It dressed up in the diplo speak of 2023. But Chairman, I have just finished the book called The Sleepwalkers by Sir Christopher Clark on the run up the years 1910 to 1914. I moved immediately into John Keegan's study of World War One because everything was miscalculation. Everything was a failure to pay attention to what the other sides were doing and to plot a worst case scenario because they didn't want to think about a worst case scenario. And they ended up with a worst case scenario because no one spoke clearly. My colleague Dennis Prager likes to say clarity before agreement. No one speaks clearly. Xi speaks clearly. We just don't want to listen to him.
That's correct, too. Let me be clear as well. Listen, I have no problem if we want to set up what's called a crisis communication channel. I think it makes a lot of sense so that, you know, our generals can talk to their generals and there's no miscalculation that might lead to war. What I disagree with the administration on is this idea that economic engagement or cooperation on a discrete set of issues, usually they talk about climate change, or they talk about non-proliferation, or they talk about stability on the Korean Peninsula, that somehow, A, the Chinese Communist Party is going to be a productive collaborator on those issues, and B, that cooperation will reduce tension in the overall relationship. Because if you don't deal with the main thing, which is the CCP's expanding aggression, which is particularly focused on Taiwan right now, and as I've told you many times in some meaningful sense, the invasion of Taiwan has already begun in cyberspace and in the information space. If you don't deal with that issue, and if you're not clear about that issue, then I'm not sure how the relationship improves. Moreover, we need to remember that we are not the aggressor in this relationship. It is the CCP which is upending the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. It is the CCP which flew a spy balloon over the continental United States. And despite that, and now we have reports that the State Department tried to de-emphasize that, tried to slow roll information on that, is still precluding Congress from getting a fulsome assessment of what happened so as not to endanger these bilateral meetings. I actually think that just makes us look weak. The CCP reads that as an invitation for more aggression. It's a paradox of Marxist-Leninist regimes that the more secure they are, the more aggressive they become.
The neo-appeasement that's in the water, and everyone takes that as an insult. I don't mean it as an insult. I mean it as a genuine ideology that dominated in the 30s from Stanley Baldwin through Neville Chamberlain, which is you can satisfy dictators. You can actually do a deal with a dictator that they will stick to. That's back, and it's deep. We saw Reagan beat it in the 80s with the deployment of the Pershings and the cruise missiles. But it's back, and the neo-appeasers don't want to deal with Xi. How is the committee going to get that to change? Will the Democrats on the committee be vital to that change?
Well, we're hoping to have our first set of policy recommendations out next week. We're working towards a strong set of recommendations that are focused on Taiwan, as well as a smaller set of strong recommendations that came out of our hearing on the ongoing Uyghur genocide, which leads to something that we're doing tomorrow night. We're having a hearing tomorrow night on the CCP's ongoing economic aggression globally and how we level the playing field. We have as witnesses Roger Robinson, who designed and was key to the implementation of Ronald Reagan's economic warfare strategy against the Soviet Union. We have Bob Lighthizer, who served as U.S. Trade Representative. And we have Eric Schmidt, who obviously was the head of Google and brings a private sector experience. And so we're hoping that hearing will then tee up our broader effort, which is the next phase of the committee's work, which is focused on selective economic decoupling and how we win this economic competition. Because a lot of the sentiment for engagement and appeasement comes from the private sector. It comes from Wall Street. It comes from K Street. It comes from Hollywood. It comes from Silicon Valley. And there's this naive belief that we can just go back to the status quo, ante, that somehow we can go back to the good old days and return to the responsible stakeholder hypothesis, or, the more theme parks we open up in China, the better behaved Xi Jinping will become. I disagree with that, but we need to have a conversation with the private sector and get them to understand that there is no such thing as a private business in China. Business does not exist solely for business sake. Business exists for the party's sake. You do business at Xi Jinping's, by the grace of Xi Jinping. He owns your business if it's in China. He could snap a finger and have access to any of your IP or any of your business operations.
So last question, Chairman Gallagher. Is there any doubt in your mind that a million Uyghurs are in prison camps there? I want people to understand. I don't know how we normalize with a genocidal regime. Have they stopped the genocide?
No. But there's a lot of people trying to ignore it. I would direct your listeners to our committee's website. And we have just horrific testimony from survivors of the concentration camp, women who were subject to beating, forced sterilization. I mean, the stories are horrific. We've said never again for many, many decades now. And yet this is happening again. This isn't just Republican Mike Gallagher. It's two administrations, Democrat and Republican, that have said there's an ongoing genocide in the Xinjiang Autonomous Region, and we ignore it at our own peril.
Well, then how do we do business with a genocidal regime? It's like we knew about the concentration camps prior to 38, but we'd still do deal. It's as though we did. We didn't, but this time we do, right?
Yeah, it's the same theory that economic entanglement will somehow improve the relationship and produce peace. But now we have multiple decades of experience to suggest that that doesn't work. Like, there's a logic to that approach. I get it. The only problem is it did not work. And so to double down on that hypothesis would be literal insanity. We should not do that. We need to be selectively decoupling in key areas.
Chairman Mike, there is no losing in sports. Gallagher, it is great to see you. I'll see you later today. Thank you for joining me as always. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. That music means Admiral Stavridis is in the house. Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander, former commander of Southern Command, now chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation. His colleagues at the Carlyle Group are among the smartest in D.C., and he does a bunch of other stuff as well as write for Bloomberg. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. Instead of being in the house from now on, I'd like to say Admiral Stav is on the ship.
On the ship. All right. On the deck. Or on the the bridge.
On deck.
On the bridge.
Right.
Now, Admiral, you are expert in matters Turkey because they are a NATO member. So you spent a lot of time in Turkey working with, I assume, President Erdogan and the NATO and the Turkey armed forces. He's in a runoff. Looks like a prohibitive favorite. What do you think?
I think he's probably at the 75% to 80% chance of winning this election. And I want to make two points, kind of good news, bad news. Good news about Turkey, throughout my time as Supreme Allied Commander, Turkey was a highly responsive nation to the alliance. Everything we asked for, troops in Afghanistan, ships in counter-piracy, aircraft for Libya, they delivered. And they delivered well, and the armed forces, highly professional. Here's the bad news, Hugh, and a lot of your listeners will know this. Over the last 10 years, under first prime minister, now President Erdogan, the Turks have gotten closer and closer to Russia. They purchased advanced air defense systems from them. We object to that. It creates vulnerabilities to NATO air defenses. They have pushed back, I think, preposterously on the membership of Finland and Sweden. They finally caved on Finland. Hopefully they will allow Sweden following this election, whichever way it goes. So it's a mixed picture coming out of Turkey. I'm hopeful that Erdogan, when he does get reelected, will recognize, okay, this is the point. It's peak Erdogan. I can't get any stronger in the country. Now I can move closer to the alliance and closer to the West. That's my hope. We'll see what happens.
All right. Now I want to turn to the CCP. I just talked about this with Chairman Gallagher at a lunch last week with a foreign national who's very smart and two longtime Beltway players, very smart, and Democrats. All three of them agreed that China will not go to war over Taiwan. And I'm kind of taken aback by that. They just don't think it'll happen. They want to believe it's going to be a gradual takeover by Xi, a merger of two systems into one country. I just think they want to believe that, Admiral. And Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, spent a couple of days in Vienna, had a little bit of the neo-appeasement flavor about it because they haven't released the Uyghurs and they haven't scuttled any ships. What do you think about refusing to believe that the Chinese are actually going to attack Taiwan or anywhere else?
I don't think it's an on and off switch here. In other words, I don't think you have to believe China is going to attack Taiwan in the coming months or even next few years, or your other position is, oh, no, it'll never happen. It's not an on and off switch. It's kind of a rheostat. You dial it in. And I would say the position of that rheostat right now, in my view, is closer to they probably won't use a military means to attack Taiwan. And the reasons are they're worried about sanctions. They would come. They're worried about how hard the Taiwanese would fight. I think they'll fight hard. They're worried about the global impact to the economy. So I would say that rheostat, you know, that dimmer, if you will, in your dining room is dialed a little closer to the they probably won't go the military route. But you'd be naive and foolish to simply wish away the possibility, because I'll close with this. For President Xi, Taiwan is a red line. He will fight rather than let Taiwan become independent. That would be the one thing that would slam that dimmer all the way to the left and lead to a military confrontation would be a Taiwanese declaration of independence.
Now, let me also, what about just the presidential election next year?
Yeah. Here, I think it lends itself to that dial being closer to we're probably not looking at the military, because Madam Tsai is running again, and her opponent is someone who is closer to China. Neither of them are going to simply fold the tent and become part of China in a fulsome way. But Tsai is the most, the one who is furthest away from China. Her opponent is closer to China. So I don't see anything in that election that's suddenly going to create a rush or a declaration of independence, which again is the red line for President Xi.
Now, Admiral, you and Dr. Al Mohler are the two people who I never can seem to read a book that you haven't already read. So the book I want to talk about is The Sleepwalkers, by Sir Kenneth Clark, the Regius Professor of History at Oxford. Have you read The Sleepwalkers?
I have. And as you know, it's about how the Europeans managed to sleepwalk into the First World War. And the book is excellent. And I think that you can, I assume this is where you're going with the comment, you could postulate that U.S. and China could find themselves sleepwalking into a war that ultimately would be not good for either country. That's certainly what happened in Europe in 1914. By the way, you know this, but the classic of that World War One, How Did It Happen? Literature is Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August, which stands up very well and won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1960s.
Now, Clark has received every award going, and there's additional scholarship since Tuchman wrote that epic Guns of August, which was a popular bestseller. This is much more into the details. One of the things that I took away is that Sir Edwin Grey, for whom I've always had a lot of admiration, actually didn't do such a good job in communicating to the Germans what the Brits would do if Russia mobilized and France mobilized, because we had persuaded the French, the Brits had persuaded the French to send their fleet to the Mediterranean so that their north coast was naked. And a cabinet divided among itself swung over to going all into the war. that they didn't really know how long it would go or how terrible and ghastly it would be because of ambiguity. And I see a lot of ambiguity right now, Admiral. And so I walked away from that book thinking, clarity before agreement, as my friend Prager says, strategic ambiguity has served its purpose. It is time to be very clear about our red lines. Are you there yet?
I am not quite there, but I'll tell you someone who is, who you ought to bring onto the show to talk about these issues if you have not already. And this is Admiral Harry Harris, commander of the Pacific Command. Interestingly, Japanese-American deeply understands the region in every dimension and most recently served as our ambassador in Seoul in South Korea. And Harry Harris, I was just chatting with him about this. He is there. He believes your point that it is time for clarity. He lays out a pretty persuasive case in that direction. Personally, I'm not quite there. I think we could continue with the policy we currently have. It's served us well for many, many years. It creates uncertainty in the minds of the CCP. It, I think, still has functionality. Its hour is probably drawing to a close.
I'd love to get the Admiral on. Tip me to where I can find him. I'll track him down. But this goes to the central question of miscalculation in war. And you've just read all the literature. I'm not really surprised that you read The Sleepwalkers, although it's a long and dense book. It has been out for a decade, so a lot of people who want to get into that literature. That literature comes away saying, we really can't blame anyone. No one knew what was going on. Last minute, Admiral, I got to do a couple of things. When does anyone know what would happen if China invaded Taiwan? Has anyone figured it out?
Absolutely not. And that is good in the sense that it creates that ambiguity in the mind of China, keeps them wary. On the other hand, and this is your point, wouldn't it be better to achieve some clarity? I'm getting closer to that. I will connect you with Admiral Harris. He will lay that case out pretty well for you.
Admiral Stav, always a pleasure. Follow him at Stavridis J on Twitter. The Admiral is always writing and thinking and usually posts where you can find his stuff at Bloomberg and elsewhere. Thank you, Admiral. I want to take this opportunity to ask my audience to do what you've been doing all week, which is supporting AngelTree. And I'm going to ask you once an hour for the next 30 days or 20 broadcast days or whatever it is to please do so, because we got to fill up the camps and the budget. None of these kids have money. None of the kids of the incarcerated have $200. And it costs $200 to go to camp. And some of you, if $200 is something you wouldn't blink twice at right now to send your own child to camp, if you would just say, sure, $200 for the church camp, I'll send them up to wherever they need to go. And I want them to go to the VBS, or I want them to go to Girl Scout or Boy Scout camp, or I want them to go off to this special academic camp or theater camp or music camp or band camp. Here's $200. If you're in that category of here's $200, would you give another $200 to support a child you do not know and will never meet until the next life, getting to the AngelTree camp where they're going to find that life can be good and people love them, even though there are some tough circumstances in which they are growing up? As we hear in this clip, I love this clip because AngelTree has great, 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 great staff, and they really take care of these kids. Betsy Wright is among them. Give a listen to Betsy Wright.
You know, they dropped their child off at the beginning of the week. Child was super hesitant, just didn't know if they wanted to go to camp. And by the end of the week, when mom comes back to pick them up, they're crying because they don't want to go home because they had so much fun. And we hear, I think it was a grandmother, she said, this was the first time that my child went to sleep without the sounds of gunshot at night.
All right. So that means a tough, tough neighborhood. And there are neighborhoods, and I lived in one way back in 1980 when it's all I could afford in Upper West Side of New York. I had to go way north to find a place to live. And in 1980, way north, north of 116th was definitely no-go land. And it was and Central Park on my east, was also no-go land at night. And you'd hear gunfire. And it's just an unusual thing. It's not like downtown Chicago or anything like that today. But get kids out of that. Send them out to the lake. Let them jump on the water weenie like you heard the kid talking about yesterday. Let them go waveboarding. Let them go tubing. Let them enjoy the archery that they can't hit anything, but it's kind of fun. Angel Tree Camp. If you can write a check for $200, great. If you can write a check for $1,000, great. If you can write one for $10,000, even better. You can make a donation of any amount at the banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. And if you can't afford $200, but you've got $20 and you want to help send a kid to camp, 10 of you will make that so. And believe me, there's a room in that mansion for you for taking care of children you do not know and will never meet. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Bethany Mandel is next. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Bethany Mandel. She, of course, is the author of Stolen Youth, and she joins me each week at this time. Good morning, Bethany. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
Good, but your backdrop changes every time. I never know where you're going to be when you're broadcasting. Bethany, did you watch the town hall a week ago tonight?
With Trump? No, I like myself far too much to subject myself to this, but I've been seeing all the hysterics on the media, so I feel like I got the experience.
A lot of that hysterics on the media have been directed at the audience, which clapped or didn't clap. And I watched the audience. Some people always clap, some people never clapped. But there is just genuine contempt for people who like Donald Trump. Now, I'm in Switzerland. Yeah. What is the source of that contempt?
I mean, I think that contempt is elitism. They are so disgusted with anyone who might have a different life. I mean, it's funny because Democrats traditionally, I think, have portrayed themselves to be the party of the working class. And that has really changed over the course of the last 10 years. Now, it's become very racial and very sort of oppressor versus oppressed versus working class or not. But all of Trump's support is from white working class America. And that could not be more disgusting demographic for people in the elites, mostly in the media.
So there's contempt for religious people in the media. There's contempt mm-hmm. for people like you who are homeschoolers. There are contempt for Trump voters. There are contempt for people who work for their hand. When did that start? I don't remember the media having contempt when I was your age for anyone. At least they pretended not to. Yeah.
So, I mean, the media looks very different than it did 15, 20 years ago. It used to be that you could earn a living for, you know, in the beginning of your career. And now that's not the case anymore. Now you really have to have a benefactor of some kind in order to rise up in the media. If you follow media personalities on Instagram, it's very telling because they take vacation. There is no way they could afford on their media dollar. They have to be able to work from home. Their parents are paying them. So in order to gain admittance to the higher rungs of the media, you have to come from a pretty wealthy background. And that infers some contempt for people who were your electrician and your plumber and all of those vocations that are more traditionally working class. But the contempt that they hold sort of comes through in their coverage of their subjects and also for colleagues that don't fit their elite status. My number one person who comes to mind is Selena Zito, who is just reviled by these people. She was slandered and they really hate her. I talk to her very frequently. You do as well. And they hate that she gives voice to these people.
Why do you think there is this? I know why they hire each other. Like they hire themselves and it's gotten bad over years. It's evolved into a kind of pinnacle of elitism inside legacy media. But why have contempt from which you can't? Do they not get out much, which is my number one theory, is that they don't leave the Beltway or Manhattan?
No, they don't. I mean, you saw the election, the 2016 election, where they all tried to cover it from sitting at their desk in New York or in Washington. And they got it wrong because they just did not understand. Selena Zito drove all around Pennsylvania and the Rust Belt. And she said, I don't know. I think there's something here. And Selena Zito was right. And the rest of them were wrong. They ensconce themselves in a bubble within a bubble. So they have not just their media elite friends, but then they don't leave the DC and New York area or they go back and forth and they're like the Acela people. But they don't have any experience. Some of them might have grown up adjacent to working class America, but that's really the extent of it.
So my last question is, the audience applauded Trump, not all of it, but some of it, when he cast doubt on Jean Carroll after the verdict came in. And this was considered to be sacrilege. Believe me, I've been counsel to a lot of parties who've lost a lot of lawsuits or are unhappy with the jury. And I think it was a right sketchy set of facts anyway. But does being skeptical of the verdict in any way lower your esteem for someone who is? Because it doesn't mine. It just doesn't, because it's a sketchy verdict.
It's, I mean, the whole thing is sketchy. I think the course of the last 5 years has taught us to be very distrustful of conventional wisdom. And when I hear, especially when it comes to Trump, everything that has happened, Russiagate comes to mind first. Everything that was conventional wisdom about Trump, it was like, of course you believe this. Of course you have to think this. It turns out within weeks, days, months that, oh no, that was completely fabricated out of whole cloth. And so this is just sort of one of those instances where just on its face, it sounds fishy. And even if you don't know that much about it, you're like, I don't know. That puts up my radar there seems to be more to the story. And every time individuals are like, I kind of want to wait to hear more of the story because that sounds fishy, they are rewarded with being right.
Yeah, but the contempt they endure in between is quite a lot. Bethany Mandel, follow her at Bethany Shondark on Twitter. Go get her book, Stolen Youth, and keep coming back. Bethany, I always appreciate talking to you on a Tuesday. Don't go anywhere, America. Molly Hemingway is next. Senator Cotton, Senator Cornyn, what's going on at the border, and more importantly, in the debt limit talks. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. It's Dwayne Patterson of the Hugh Hewitt Show. The last time we talked, I was about 3 weeks into a 50-pound weight loss project with my PhD, weightloss.com. I had lost 16 pounds after 3 weeks. Today, I've lost 50 pounds in just 12 weeks and have been able to keep it off for the last 2 months. And you can, too. MyPhDWeightLoss.com has all the information, or 864-644-1900.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor. She also joins me most Tuesdays when we are lucky. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning.
The Durham report dropped. There has been the predicted reaction of ho-hum, nothing new. We've known this all along. The bow gets knotted up 6.5 years after Team Clinton drops this and pollutes the water of 2016. Anything else to learn from this?
Well, there is a truth that justice delayed is justice denied. And as I was reading through the report, which is absolutely explosive to have everything, yeah, it's a lot of stuff we already knew, but to have it all laid out in chronological order or to look at how what was known at what time and therefore why the FBI mishandled things is very informative. But it would have been great if we could have had this type of report, if more people would have fought against the Russia collusion hoax in 2016, 2017, 2018. I mean, it affected multiple elections. It was done by our own government and the Democrat Party and the media against the American people. And it's a real dark mark on American history.
It is, Molly. And what's amazing that no one's brought up yet, I just didn't want to steal your thunder if you've gotten there. It's a complete indictment of the Mueller special counsel report. Because they found none of this. They had far more time. They had far more money, far more media attention. They found none of this. In fact, they couldn't even bring themselves to tell people that it was all cooked up.
Well, not just that. The whole point of the Mueller probe, supposedly, and the real point was to undermine the Trump administration. But the point was to discover how Russia had interfered in our election. That's what they claimed. Well, this Durham report shows all the ways that Russia knew about the Hillary Clinton campaign idea to come up with this lie that Donald Trump was a Russian agent, how anything that they were getting from Russian sources would have reflected that reality that Russia knew and therefore would have been Russian disinformation or misinformation, and how our FBI just played right along with it.
So we got played for 4 years, and the former president is rightly angry over getting played by Brennan Clapper and Comey in the transition meeting in Trump Tower on the first January 6, 2017. My question is, I don't think anything has changed. I don't think a word, and I like Christopher Wray. I've never met him, but I was told he's a good guy. I don't think the FBI has changed, because if it had changed, we would know what the bottom line in Hunter is. the whole deal at the FBI is slow roll everything that helps a Republican and expedite everything that hurts them. That's it. It's a partisan place.
There was this line in the Durham report where he says, we could come up with new rules and guidance to prevent this kind of abomination from happening, but it wouldn't matter unless they change the culture of the place. He says something like, until and unless the FBI begins to care about fidelity, bravery, and integrity, which is what people always say the FBI stands for, then it won't matter at all. I mean, it's a brutal indictment of the culture of the FBI that goes all the way to the top, but it goes pretty far down too. If based on what we learn in this Durham investigation, it is a horrific threat to the Republic to have this powerful law enforcement agency that protects friends and allies like the Biden family. And I mean, what we're learning about from whistleblowers about the manner in which they're protecting the Biden family is extensive, and then willing to destroy democracy itself if the wrong person, according to the FBI, wins a presidential contest. I mean, it's terrifying to think about, and it's massive news. And, you know, you said you feel bad for Trump, and that you should. Everyone should, you know, everyone should have some pity here for what happened, not just to him, but to his administration, to the country itself. This was a four-year-long undermining of the 2016 election.
Now, I want to try and explain it in terms that the Beltway might understand, Molly. James Comey was to the FBI what Dan Snyder was to the Washington Redskins, now Commanders. And Dan Snyder created a culture of complete dysfunction, abuse, secrecy. Everything is off the rails. And they finally forced him. The NFL realized he's not in good for the Shield. They're forcing him out. Comey was forced out. But the new owners of the Redskins, now Commanders, are going to have to change everybody in that organization, I think, top to bottom. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I think that it could happen. I mean, it would require a lot of work. It would require right now, too, not just some Republicans to care about this, but Democrats as well. But there are enough good people within the agency who are appalled by what they witnessed, appalled by what it did to the reputation of the FBI, that there's certainly more than enough to work with there.
Now, I want to switch subjects on you back to the town hall last week, because I'm writing something for the Post about this. What has struck me the most is the palpable contempt for the audience that has not been hidden from mainstream media's accounts. They have contempt for the audience because the audience doesn't believe Jean Carroll. They have contempt for the audience because the audience believes the 2020 election was sketchy. Not necessarily rigged. Trump uses the word rigged, but they think, the audience thinks, Zuckerberg boxes, changing rules, Pennsylvania Supreme Court. They don't think that the voting machines were fixed, right? That's what I think they believe. But the contempt for them that drips in 9 out of 10 reports, it doesn't drip, it showers, Molly. It's everywhere.
I think it's because the audience was mocking them because they thought they had so much, they thought the media had so much power over what people think about Republicans or Donald Trump or the E. Jean Carroll case, which I think, you know, people who supported it mostly thought of it as just one of these means by which you can take down the top Republican contender, not that people actually thought that that was a, you know, super legitimate case. They are appalled that years after what was undeniably the weirdest election we've ever gone through, where hundreds of laws and processes were changed, some of them legally, some of them not, where Mark Zuckerberg put in $419 million to take over the government election offices with private money to drive up Democrat votes in swing states, where the media lied and invented stories, where big tech suppressed information. Of course they think it was rigged. I mean, I think anyone who's being honest and accurate, we'll have to admit that was the weirdest election we have ever gone through. And it happened very suddenly in the months prior to COVID that all these changes were implemented. And they're mad that they told you that you're not allowed to notice that. And then the entire audience noticed it. And so I thought that audience was actually a really big part of the effectiveness of the debate in making the left realize that they, through all of their censorship and through all of their aggression, they haven't actually convinced people. They've just controlled the information.
What they have done, Ma, is drop the veil. They have contempt for Trump supporters, and they have contempt for Republicans, including DeSantis supporters, And that contempt, it's like a Superfund site. Legacy Media is like a Superfund site. It needs remediation for over a course of years to change it. And I don't think they've even begun.
I love that metaphor so much. And it's making, you imagine what you do to a Superfund site to take care of it. And it is not that you allow it to keep growing or whatnot. But yeah, this is the disdain and contempt that we've seen for years. And we now see that the left media has done nothing to improve the situation. You did see, I think Chris Licht said in his town hall with his staff that, of course we need to show these people. Of course we need to show who their candidates are. Like, I thought you guys knew you were a news organization, and the rebellion from inside CNN about how they actually did not think that they were a news organization. They thought they were an activist group, and that's what they've been doing for several years. So they're having.
I think Chris Licht is trying. I've only met him once. I think he's trying. But like a Superfund site, don't bring a shovel to a Superfund site. You bring a whole bunch of backhoes and a whole bunch of people in suits, and you get rid of whoever ran it in the first place. You don't let the people, and I did Superfund stuff for a year. You don't let them near the Superfund site because, A, they're going to try and cover their track. I just don't know that the media can be saved, Molly. I just don't.
I was thinking about it yesterday when they were pretending to cover the Durham report. I'm like, the very last people in the world you would want to understand or analyze the Durham report are the people who participated in the Russia collusion hoax. Some of these media figures were main major players in spreading this lie that caused so much damage, not just domestically, but globally, that Donald Trump had stolen the 2016 election by being a Russian traitor. Now, you don't go to those people to tell you to report, to get the honest, accurate information about what's in the Durham report, because they're implicated in it.
Yeah. Molly, I always love talking to you. Follow her at MZ Hemingway. She has the goods on the judiciary and on the election. And when you hear people say the election was rigged, they're not talking about the voting machine. They're talking about all that other stuff. Best example, the Hunter Biden story being suppressed. That's that part of the rigging. And that's why they were applauding Donald Trump, not because they believe his more absurd claims about the election. I just wish people could be more discerning about reactions to Trump. Molly Hemingway, thank you. I'll be right back, America.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back.
Hey, Hugh. Good morning. It's good to be back on with you.
Your reaction to the Durham report?
Well, the Durham report, I think, confirmed most of what we already knew or strongly suspected, that the FBI and the Department of Justice in 2016 applied very different standards to the Clinton campaign and to the Trump campaign. And they continued on this baseless witch hunt against President Trump and associates from his campaign on information that they knew to be unreliable and in some cases planted by political operatives. There has not yet been sufficient accountability for the FBI and the Department of Justice because of these failures and this misconduct. You know, in the Trump era, a few were dismissed. Some of them in the Biden era have even been reinstated or had their dismissals upgraded. There needs to be that kind of accountability for the American people to have confidence in the FBI, especially its senior leadership.
Now, Senator Cotton, you're on judiciary. I believe you have oversight of DOJ and FBI, correct?
Yes, we did, Hugh.
So I have analogized the Bureau to a Superfund site, and Molly Hemingway loves it, so I'm going to test that out on you. I don't think remediation has begun. They put someone in charge of Superfund site, and that's Director Ray, but I don't know that the remediation has begun beyond moving stroke and page out.
I think that's about right, Hugh. That's about all the accountability that there was, aside from Donald Trump removing Jim Comey. My main complaint about President Trump's dismissal of Jim Comey is it happened 5 months too late. He should have done it on his very first day in office because Director Comey had lost the confidence of the American people going back to the summer and the fall of 2016. Lisa Page and Peter Strzok are examples of people who were removed under the Trump era, along with Andy McCabe. But again, some of their dismissals have been upgraded. There needs to be accountability for the people at the department and the FBI who engaged in this misconduct. This doesn't touch on the vast majority of FBI agents, many of whom I know, I crossed paths with in school, or the Army, or I've worked with in Arkansas. Those agents are patriotic. They're dedicated professionals. Many of them have told me they are appalled by what people like Jim Comey and Andy McCabe and Lisa Page and Peter Strzok did and the discredit it brought to the Bureau. Christopher Wray has not sufficiently held the senior leadership of the FBI to account. And, of course, there are still officials in the Department of Justice outside the FBI who have not been held to account.
Now, Senator Cotton, I haven't read the Durham report yet. I've read all the news reports, and nobody answered my question. Maybe you know. Did Durham call to task the Mueller investigation, either Special Counsel Mueller or Deputy Counsel Weinstein, or excuse me, any of those people, because they obviously missed this whole thing? The Mueller report, two volumes of it, did not discover this. I think I'm completely correct about that. But did the Durham report call out the Mueller report?
Hugh, I'm still working my way through it as well, so I can't give you a definitive answer. If he didn't call them out, I think in part maybe because it was beyond the scope of his review. But the Mueller investigation should have never been created in the first place. The FBI and the Department of Justice knew at the time Director Mueller was appointed as special counsel that the so-called Steele dossier was nothing but Clinton campaign lies. There was nothing to investigate. Many people were charged with offenses that were purely process offenses based on their own witch hunt against Donald Trump and everyone that was associated with him. That was a direct result, again, of dismissing Jim Comey. That's why I wish Donald Trump had done it on day one in his in office, just based on the loss of credibility that Jim Comey had suffered in 2016. But there's no question that the Mueller investigation was both needless, and it was specifically designed to try to upend the Trump presidency from the very beginning, which it deeply, deeply interfered with for almost 2 years.
Now, Senator, I know you didn't watch the CNN town hall last week. We've talked about that already. But in the post games that have gone on for a week, there has been a complete display of contempt for the audience. It was a Republican audience, as it was agreed to be a Republican audience, because Republican primaries are for Republican voters. But the legacy media just hates that audience. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah, of course, Hugh. And you can see the contempt that traditional liberal media show for Republican voters and that Republican audience is kind of a microcosm of it. Just look at debate questions over the years, Hugh. They don't take the point of view of a center-right Republican primary voter. They take the point of view of a left liberal journalist, or in some cases, activist. I mean, I think most notoriously, when George Stephanopoulos asked Mitt Romney about banning birth control or some such question in 2012, not something that was on the mind at all of Republican primary voters in 2012, but something that the Obama campaign wanted to falsely accuse the Romney campaign and other Republicans of pursuing. Hugh, this is one reason why the RNC wanted to take a stronger hand and who's going to be moderating this question. You don't expect people to ask softballs or layups of presidential candidates, but you do expect them to express the perspective of a Republican primary voter who has questions about individual candidates. And, Hugh, I think the contrast was stark in the clips I've seen since last week in that CNN town hall. You had a CNN reporter who kept asking about all the hair on fire, democracy dies in darkness type stuff of Donald Trump that the press was asking about for 8 years. And then you had Republican primary voters asking simple questions like, why didn't you finish the wall? Or what should we do about China? These are the things that normal Americans who are traditional Republican primary voters care about.
Let's go to the wall, Senator. The rate of immigration under of migrants without permission entering the country in the last full fiscal year of Donald Trump was under 500,000. Last year, it was 2.5 million. This year, it's going to be 4 million. I don't know how anyone looks at this and says it's other than a disaster for everyone involved. The migrants, the border towns, the rest of the country. Yet Secretary Mayorkas says they got a plan. What do you say to him? I mean, it's just so absurd.
Hugh, their only plan is to process these illegal aliens more promptly. You know, they made a show of deploying 1,500 soldiers to the border a week ago. Those soldiers are not going there to defend our border, to protect them, protect it from a de facto invasion. They're going to help expedite the paperwork so illegal aliens can enter our country more effectively. You know, Secretary Mayorkas broadcast and celebrated an app that the Department of Homeland Security has created. That app, again, is to help illegal aliens with no justifiable claim to enter our country to enter it more quickly. You know, I've heard some Democrats claiming, well, we need some kind of immigration reform bill, you know, border security and asylum reform. And, you know, we've got to get protections for the Dreamers as well. Well, first off, their border security view, I promise you, is not going to be actual border security. Their version of asylum reform would simply be institutionalizing and legislating the oxen approach to asylum that the Biden administration has implemented. And finally, they say, well, we've got to get something in return. No, no. The Democrats have gotten what they wanted already. They've gotten 6 million new illegal aliens in this country in the last 2.5 years.
So the question becomes, what is going to happen? Denver Mayor Michael Hancock, I'm going to play cut number 6 to the studio. He is a Democrat. And like Kathy Hochul, another Democrat, he said, we're all Phil at the end. Cut number 6 for Senator Cotton.
You know, we are seeing a bit of a lull, if you will, in the number of migrants that are coming into Denver, at least in the last 3 or 4 days of the week and then through the weekend. But on last Tuesday, we hit a epic number, close to 400 came through the city of Denver, again, creating a need for us to, for me to, as the mayor, to reactivate the Emergency Operations Center and to begin to put our agencies on notice and to engage everyone in our efforts to try to continue to provide the best care we can for the migrants who've come to our city.
So Senator Cotton, 400 people has got the mayor of Denver reeling. 10,000 people a day came in last week. What do you think? Where are they going?
So here I'm reminded of a trip I took to the border in the early days of the Biden administration, you know, not last month, but, you know, in the spring of 2021. And they were doing the dog and pony show for a lot of senators. I grabbed a Border Patrol agent who spoke Spanish, and we kind of walked around the side and talked to a lot of these migrants who were huddled underneath the bridge at night. And I just asked them questions about, you know, where were they from and how did they get here and how long did it take and why did they come? And not a single one of them said, oh, I was being persecuted because of my Christian faith, or my child was being threatened with blackmail and violence by a drug cartel. Every single one of them said something like, to get a job, or because I can get in, or most simply, Joe Biden. They're coming because they know they can get in. And where are they going to go? Well, a lot of them are going to end up going to big cities that already have large migrant populations. That's just the nature of immigrant flows, Hugh. You know, people come here and they go to Denver, they go to New York, they go to Dallas, they go to Phoenix, and they send word back home, you know, via text messages or DMs on social media and say, hey, you can get in and there's work here in this town. So they're going to scatter everywhere, but it's not surprising they're going to be concentrated in larger cities given traditional migrant flows. And Hugh, you're going to see more of these liberal mayors like Eric Adams in New York get exasperated with the Biden administration, because that's where the rubber hits the road. Whatever their left-wing ideology, when they've got hundreds or thousands of migrants coming in every week to their country, they've got housing problems. They've got public service problems like schools and hospitals. They've got crime and drug problems. Joe Biden may not have to deal with that ensconced in the White House, but mayors in places like New York, like Denver, and of course like El Paso do have to deal with it.
Senator Tom Cotton, always good to talk to you. I know you're one of our leading immigration hawks, and I know that you'll be involved in a conversation about immigration. John Cornyn coming up after the break. Thank you, Senator Cotton. I want to remind everyone that Angel Tree Prison Fellowships, Angel Tree Camps are open. I just got a note from one of my subtexters. If you belong to the universe, I text out a variety of things to people. I also get, it's my focus group. I don't read the public-facing mailbox because too many crazy people and trolls email there. But I do, if you're a member of the universe, you can sign up for my text messages where I pose a question to the, there are a few thousand of you in there. And I then hear back from you. And one of my very generous text messengers said, we just sent our kid to camp, cost $700. So if the Angel Tree Prison Fellowship is sending a kid for $200, we know it's subsidized and we will send a kid. I love that. It is subsidized. Prison Fellowship raises money for a variety of ministries and efforts to reach the people behind bars, but also to take care of their families. I think the most important one is the summer camp. A lot of people like the Christmas present. I do both. They sponsor campaigns both times of the year, and I'm glad to have them on. I'm glad to have their sponsorship, and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I contribute to them because they deliver. In this case, they deliver a week out in the woods for children who are having one or both parents in prison. And you can help Angel Tree by going over to the banner at HughHewitt.com and donating today. $200 sends another kid, but if you can only send 20, great. If you can send 20,000, better. Or you can call 888-206-2764. 888-206-2764. 888-206-2764. Send a kid to camp this summer. Change their life. I'll be right back with Senator Cornyn. Stay tuned. What's going on at the border? Not much, except come on in.
Things are going at the border, sir.
Much better than you all expected.
Do you have any plans to visit the border?
No, I think. Pardon me?
Do you have any plans to visit the border?
Not in the near term, no.
Much better than you people expected. Ha, ha, ha. That was the president out on his bicycle on this weekend in Delaware. Senator John Cornyn is from Texas. Is it a laughing matter in Texas, Senator?
Absolutely not. It's outrageous what the Biden administration has allowed at the border. And now it's going to get worse as a result of his policies. I have zero confidence and the president and Secretary of Homeland Security, who say the border's secure, when our eyes tell us that it is not even close.
Well, it is 10,000 people a day last week. It is apparently less this week, but I don't know what to project forward because they got an app and they think the app is the solution. Senator Cotton just said it just makes a more orderly welcome pass. What do you think about it? Is it the fast pass in the United States?
Yeah, it sure is. What really has to happen to you is that what they say they will do, which I frankly don't believe, which is they will use expedited removal to remove people who come between the ports of entry. They said that if you come between the port of it and through a port of entry and use the app, then you'll be processed like any other asylees. The problem is when they release people into the interior of the country or they parole them, which is in this instance just means waving them on through, it just is it's a magnet to draw more and more people to the border. So then that's what's been happening for the last 2 years.
Now, I just played the tape. I'm not going to play it again for Senator Cotton, of the mayor of Denver saying, man, we had 400 people here last week. We were maxed out. And I got the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, saying the same thing. In fact, let's play that for the senator. Cut number five, Kathy Hochul on MSNBC with Al Sharpton. Cut number five.
Well, Reverend Al, hearing the numbers going down is good news, but it's small comfort to us because the word we're getting is that the majority of these individuals who are crossing, and it's still high numbers, are coming to New York State. And we already have over 61,000, over 40,000 housed in New York City. They're bursting at the seams, and Mayor Adams is doing the very best he can in a difficult situation. We have stepped in. $1 billion from the state.
All right, so 41,000 is too many for New York City, Senator Cornyn. How's El Paso doing?
Well, we've seen a heck of a lot more than that. We've had about 5 million border encounters since President Biden became president. And as I said, his policies of non-enforcement have been a magnet for more people to come. This is what the Border Patrol calls a pull factor. What we lack is any deterrence at all, any message that if you come, you won't be successful in getting it across the border. I want to congratulate Kevin McCarthy and the House of Representatives for passing a tough border security bill. And that represents one potential path forward, although it's a very narrow path indeed.
Senator, I want to get a quick question in on the debt limit. When do you think we run out of money that we can borrow? I mean, I don't believe the June 1 deadline, although Secretary Yellen repeated it yesterday. I just don't believe it. What do you believe?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, that's part of the problem is that we're dependent on the Secretary of the Treasury and the Biden administration to tell us when the X date is. And she said that it could be as soon as June the 1st. Which tells me it's not June the 1st, it's probably later. But I don't really understand why the Biden administration has waited all these months, knowing this was coming, to sit down and negotiate with Kevin McCarthy in the House. Apparently that's happening now. But like everything else Joe Biden does, it's usually a day late and a dollar short.
Well, one of the things I read yesterday is that if we make it to June 15th, then we can go deep into July because we get the quarterlies from self-employed people. That it just seems to me to be all artificial. I don't believe anything that anyone says in this administration, Senator. I'm sure Democrats said the same thing about the Trump administration. But here we just have just a fabric of shaded truths, lies, and everything in between.
Yeah, it's just shocking to me that people will lie to you when you know what they're telling you is not true. It's really a terrible shame when you can't trust the leaders of our government in the executive branch. And, you know, the Durham report, which I know you've looked at, is confirms the worst about the FBI's abuse of the legal process against the Trump administration using a opposition research paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. It's very disturbing.
I would love to have someone call anyone from Team Mueller as to why they didn't find this stuff out. I haven't read the whole Durham report yet. Did he call out Team Mueller at all for not finding this stuff, Senator?
I have not read it line by line. I've read some summaries of it. I'm looking forward to reading it line by line. But yeah, this has just been this is the closest thing to treason that I can think of. Trying to take down a sitting president, abusing the tools that the FBI has. It's just it's outrageous.
It is astonishing, and it is. It took 7 years to find out that the whole thing was a lie and put a bow on it. Senator Cornyn, thank you for your time. Follow him on Twitter at John Cornyn. We'll keep checking in on the border and everything else with you as the weeks go by. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be back tomorrow. Generalissimo coming up with the Grand Old Pod today. And I'll have lots more to tell you about the Durham Report tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.